until we try to maybe put 1,700 new people on them. How could we possibly keep from destabilizing the agricultural land that exists right next to this orchard? I'm a realtor by trade, and it's interesting hearing about the problems of other parts of the state. We're in a boom. Our Hood River this afternoon is crowded with people from other states. They're there largely because of the windsurfing and so forth, and our real estate market has just taken a complete about face. Prices are rising in Hood River. Properties in town with river views are staying on the market no more than, I think, if you talk to 10 realtors in town, you'd probably get an average of 2 to 3 weeks. So we don't have quite the same problem that we did a few years ago, but getting back to the meadows, we do have the potential of creating, in essence, a city within a mile of farmland, village, and bringing people in through the farmland, by the farmland, that I think eventually cannot help but be expected to start competing for that land that's right next to there. Our ownerships in Hood River are small. We're looking at orchards. A large orchard in Hood River is 150 acres. A typical orchard is 40. And as a realtor, I cannot see how we can help but destabilize the situation in having two different groups of people in the same area competing for land with two vastly different valuations in their pockets. The orchardist can pay what? $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 an acre. You can argue with people on that, but it's within that range. And then we have the people, the likes of which have very wonderful people, I want to stress here, but the likes of which can afford to pay whatever they want, that are looking at land as a house site value, a hobby farm value, where they can pay $10,000 an acre. And if we allow that situation to exist, I don't believe that there are any laws in the land that will hold up against that pressure over time. I'd like to read in my concluding remarks here, I'd like to read a letter from one of our orchardists who was unable to come. This is the busiest time of year right now. April, bar none, is the busiest month of the year for orchardists. This is from Gene Ewer, who owns an orchard right up at the upper end of the valley, close to the resort. I wish to register my opposition to the change in Section 6 of House Bill 3097. The new language, it changes the allowable distance for destination resort siting from 3 miles to 1 mile from high-value farmland. The three-mile limit was the result of a long process of compromise between agricultural and development interests. The record of discussion on this question is complete and adequate for those of the committee who will take time to study it. My testimony and that of many others convinced previous legislators to protect high-value cropland from the totally predictable consequences of resort development pressure on the limited land resources of an area like Hood River Valley. The pressure of the spring agricultural workload prevents me from appearing in person before your committee. We are farmers of over 100 acres of high-value cropland within a little over a mile of the site that Mount Hood Meadows has never given up trying to develop despite repeated legal and legislative rebuffs. I beg you to pay attention to the testimony of Richard Benner, Kate McCarthy, myself, and others about the consequences of this ill-advised change. We are a family farm with 75 years of history in the valley. We produce up to $500,000 worth of fruit per year on our 100 acres. Please allow us to concentrate on fighting diseases and weather and not have to fight land development pressures as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Representative Schroeder.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Cease and members of the committee. I'm Representative Walt Schroeder from Coos and Curry County. I can see in just listening to a very small portion of the testimony, we have a very unique and exceptional situation here. Everybody has a unique situation and an exceptional situation. I'd like to refer to the situation I've been facing in my area, right on the state line. In fact, the destination resort that has been labeled by some of the state agencies straddles the state line just south of the Winchuck River. It's called Winchuck River Estates. It will include RV park. It'll include two motels. It'll include single-family residences, condominiums, golf course, and other facilities. Now, in the bill, it indicates that land within 3 miles of a high-value crop cannot be used for a destination resort. In our area, we have some of the highest-value cropland in the state, running from $10,000 to $12,000 an acre. It grows Easter lilies, and we produce about 90% of the Easter lilies that are produced in the entire United States. That is on the harbor bench. The Winchuck River divides the harbor bench from the land below it to the California line. The land below the harbor bench is probably class 4 or 5 land. It's old, stabilized sand dune, but it is within 3 miles of high-value cropland. So this is where our situation is unique and perhaps exceptional. On the south end of the harbor bench, on that good agricultural land, before land use planning went into effect, there were several housing developments put in. So we find we have housing developments on the south end of the harbor bench. So even if we change this to within a mile of high-value land, it still would not affect the piece of ground we're talking about. The lily growers, their land ranges from anywhere from maybe a half a block to 50 acres in size in one contiguous unit. Sometimes you'll find a lily field between two houses that may be two lots apart. They're scattered all through that area. So I guess the concern I have is that if we say 3 miles or even 1 mile, it's going to affect this development very adversely. And as I started off saying this, you have a very unique situation you're dealing with and a lot of exceptional things to bring up. This just adds one more measure to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Well, we fought this battle time and time again. And my recollection is the primary reason we've put mileage figures and so on, and be it a compromise or not, was to protect the encroachment of high-value recreational land upon the value of the cropland. And from what you're telling me, if you've got sand dune type property, which won't grow anything except grass of some type, is against right up against $12,000 an acre lily bulb farm. I'm searching to find out, you know, in my own mind, struggling with it, as to how that development could possibly affect the value of the lily bulb land. And I can't seem to reconcile that in my own mind. The other key issue was the newcomers who would come into a development would be objecting to the common farming practices of spraying, aerial, etc., etc. We did fight that battle, and we won that battle for agriculture in the right to farm legislation that we've passed in prior sessions, with one exception, and that's the noise-making devices to scare the birds away. And that's going to be a battle that will always be with us. But so, you know, I'm just philosophizing about what we've been through and where we are, and certainly flexibility does not exist in our land use laws in the state of Oregon. And we find that the process is not only arcane, it's trivialized, and we obviously need a better way to get it to things, and whether it's relaxing the rules on destination resorts or whether it's finding a new process other than the reasons process of plan amendment, are things that this committee is going to have to look at. We haven't dealt with them at all since 1983 session, and so no wonder you people are coming back and back and back. But I hope the committee can listen to the testimony and see if they want to make some changes.
I might say that I do support the legislation with some of the minor amendments to be made. I think we need to protect valuable farmland. But I think we can go overboard by saying anything within 3 miles of it should be saved, because it may not be valuable farmland.
Thank you, Walt. We appreciate your testimony. Kate McCarthy? Welcome.
My name is Kate McCarthy, and I am from the Hood River Valley. We own property there. We have two orchards there and woodlands, as well as a beef operation. And I bring the bill up here. I appreciate the need in for some parts of this bill. I certainly agree with the idea that Oregon needs to promote its economy and to encourage visitors and tourism. And I realize there are many problems in making a bill work for everybody. I'm concerned about this bill because it is an attempt to seriously weaken, I feel, the control over destination resorts. There is certainly a possibility that some destination resorts should not occur in certain places. As I said before, I understand the need for economic development in Oregon. I'm also understand the increasing tourism, what increasing tourism can add to our economy. But this should be done with care and planning, and in such a way that economic development adds to and does not undermine our existing economic structure of agriculture and forestry. Oh, I started on the wrong page. Get my ducks in a row here. Okay. Again, I support the policies of in this bill, in many of them. And I also can understand the need for more smaller resorts. I think there are many people that do like to get to a smaller, simpler place. Parts of 3097 are ill-advised, I feel, and it further weakens the controls on siting destination resorts to where there is no adequate basis for preventing damaging conflicts. Nothing has a greater impact on a rural community. Talk of buffer zones of 50 or even 100 or 500 feet is ludicrous. A destination resort permeates a rural area for miles, changing the physical, social, and economic structure, to say nothing of the effect of farming practices. To have strict rules for individual residences in farm and forest zones and lax rules for laying down a whole new city is not too rational. Last session, after much study by LCDC and a citizens committee, a compromise was worked out, including the rule that destination resorts shall not be sited within 3 miles of a high crop value area. 3 miles is not very far and is not really enough. It is an irreducible minimum. 5 or 10 miles would be better, but it was agreed to as a reluctant compromise. To reduce it to 1 mile is not to keep the faith. It is a sham, meaningless as any protection at all. It would be tragic to shoot ourselves in the foot and not take care of and protect those very special high-value crop areas, but to undermine them in order to chase some unproven mirage. Sound economic development should add to our economic base. It should not sacrifice a proven existing industry. The judgment and concern of condominium and resort developers for the common good cannot always be trusted. Often they have little of their own money invested. The feasibility and appropriateness of these projects should be carefully scrutinized for the benefit of all. This bill is an attempt to seriously weaken the last controls on resort developments. As I said before, I read a little bit of this before. Now I'm relating, undermine our existing economic structure of agriculture and forestry? For instance, and now I am relating to our situation in the Hood River Valley. It makes no economic sense to site a destination resort in a small, compact fruit basket of the Hood River Valley, an area of intensive agriculture whose main industry is growing, harvesting, sorting, packing, and marketing high-value tree crop fruits. There is a tremendous economic investment in these orchards. It has taken years, in some cases over 100 years, to bring them to their present state of productivity. Our valley is uniquely suited to growing tree fruits, particularly winter pears. It benefits from marketing efforts of over 100 years. Each acre of orchard returns $5,000 to the local economy. There are about 16,000 acres of orchard. It is the largest pear-producing area in the state. The orchard industry sustains much of our economy. It employs many hundreds of people in growing, harvesting, sorting, packing, and marketing. In addition, orchards keep in business many truckers, large equipment dealers, supply houses, chemical companies, aerial sprayers, builders, field men, etc., etc. Orchards must have some stability to survive. Orchardists look 40 years into the future when they plant trees. And orchards must be constantly renewed, old trees taken out and new ones planted, to be competitive. When the long-range expectations of the landowner change to development rather than agriculture, orchardists looking into the future will cease to renew their orchards, and orchards will cease to be competitive and will go. We saw this start to happen when John Gray, a big developer, bought land in the valley. No careful analysis was made of the appropriateness or economic sense of a destination resort. The story goes that John Gray bought the property because his wife liked the view. He paid $100 an acre. Since then, the tail has been trying to wag the dog. Property values soared. Farm and forest orchard land was bought up by developers. Citizen efforts and LCDC planning have so far prevented outside money from taking over the valley. An orchard at the Parktail Junction of Cooper Spur Road, owned by a Texas developer, has been since bought back by a local orchardist. Idlewise Meadows, owned by a Portland developer, has been since bought back by local interests. Interestingly, an economic analysis prepared for the Mid-Columbia Economic Development District by Pacific Economica, Incorporated of Salem, supports the position that the resources of the Hood River Valley should be protected for fruit production. It concludes that in the growing of winter pears and other tree fruits, the county has its greatest economic advantage. And I quote from page 133 of the report. This was a report done about 1983, I think. There is a well-established record that the most frequent cause for conversion of agricultural land to other uses is the encroachment of residential land uses. It is in the communities, Hood River County's, best interest to protect its agricultural base because this is the area where it enjoys the most pronounced comparative economic advantage. Based on the findings of our analysis, the county's best interest will be served in electing a political course of action which preserves the capability for forest products and agricultural production. Further, not only should these resource lands be retained as part of the community's economic base, but future population growth, particularly in areas adjacent to forest and croplands, should be carefully controlled and managed so that commercial forestry and agriculture can continue unencumbered. That is the conclusion of an economic analysis. Our Orchard Valley is a unique and valuable resource, a heritage of generations. Our land use plan does not include a destination resort. But this one change in 3097 from 3 miles to 1 mile removes our protection. Is that what you really feel should be done? I hope not. After all these years of citizen involvement in working out sound plans, I do not really want to knock the I do not want to see the props knocked out from underneath us. Hood River County has a lot going for it. We have increasing tourism and windsurfing and the gorge, both at Cascade Locks and Hood River. The Hood River Inn, now Nendell's, is planning to double its capacity. There are spectacular sites for further lodging in Hood River and Cascade Locks. Our two mills, now both owned by Hanel, are operating, and the particle board plant is about to reopen. The port is redeveloping the waterfront area. Mount Hood already serves as a heavily used day use area for the Portland metropolitan area, as well as for the use of local people. It is not going to waste. There is ample room for further overnight accommodation of the established tourist area at the established tourist area of Government Camp, from which all ski areas may be easily reached. And one further point, the Upper Valley does not have a resort climate. It is not a Sun Valley or a Bend. We have more precipitation than the Portland area and have a long, foggy, drizzly, cold winter. There are no doubt many appropriate locations for destinations resorts in Oregon. The Upper Hood River Valley is not one of them. Changing the rules to allow a destination resort in the Upper Hood River Valley would be a tragic mistake. There is no reason but greed of developers to undermine our valuable agricultural resource, and that's not a sound enough reason.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Keith Petrie?
Oh, I wanted to pass this
okay.
picture around for you to
oh,
look
good.
At.
All right.
The valley, this is the Upper Valley, the orchard lands, and this is the Mount Tuamotu.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Keith Petrie. I'm going to try to ask people to try to hold their comments to 5 minutes so that we can move on. We've got a lot this afternoon. Welcome.
Representative Cease, members of the committee, and I will keep it brief for you. I'm representing the Oregon Ski Areas Association as their chairman. We come here to strongly support the bill, to strongly support the concept of the one-mile distance that's being discussed. I would like to refer to a recent study made by the Oregon Ski Areas Association by the University of Oregon Planning Department, which emphasizes and brings out the importance of the ski industry. The highlight of the report is the contribution you see to the economy from Central Oregon, where they have destination resorts, as compared to, I'll take the Mount Hood area, where they have just as many skiers. The difference of the impact is roughly 2 to 3 times greater. The same numbers match up for the number of jobs in Central Oregon. Mount Hood areas, the areas in Eastern Oregon, Anthony Lake, Spot Springs, could have the same opportunity for that growth and impact on their economy from their ski area if, in fact, destination resort facilities were available to that area. And then we look at Mount Hoodoo Ski Bowl, Mount Ashland, Willamette Pass are all in the same boat. Central Oregon is successful, they're unique in our state, but it comes down to the fact they have the destination resorts, the rest of us don't. I'd like to leave a copy with the committee. If more copies are not wanted, I can easily supply them. The only question that I have in my mind, and not being a lawyer or adept at reading bills, I would ask the question, are timberlands, forest lands treated the same way in this bill as agriculture lands? It seems that this bill is directed at agriculture land, not forest land. And I would recommend to the committee that they give this consideration. Senator Yee, who I think would be faced in the same problem that much of her lands, potential lands there, could be forest land as well or as agriculture land. So I would ask that be given consideration. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Richard Benner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Benner. I'm a staff attorney with 1,000 Friends. Although I signed up in opposition to the bill, that is because we oppose portions of it. We think that there are other provisions in the bill that ought to receive your favorable consideration. Before I get into my testimony, I want to point out to the committee that 1,000 Friends has historically been in favor of easing the process for the siting of destination resorts. Beginning in 1982, when the question first arose, leading on to the appointment by Governor Attia of a joint committee of LCDC and the Economic Development Commission, and then culminating in the adoption of the Goal 8 Amendment by LCDC in 1984, we supported that process. We think that the question of how to deal with destination resorts and to try to accommodate them in Oregon without destabilizing agriculture or forestry is not an easy question. It's complicated. And it took LCDC and the joint EDC-LCDC committee quite some time to come up with a solution. As you know, the Goal 8 Amendment didn't make everybody happy. And probably the thing that frustrated the commission most when it was at the point of making its final action was how to deal with smaller resorts. It was inclined to want to do something with smaller resorts, but it wanted to do something fast for large resorts because it thought the economy would get a bigger hit. They wanted to do it as soon as they could, and they simply didn't want to slow down and take the time to deal with the small resorts question. That's the portion of House Bill 3097 which I think deserves some attention from you. I think there's much there that we can support. There are a couple of points where we have a complaint, but I do think that we can make some progress on that. It's the other portion of the bill where we must register our opposition, and that is the portion that attempts to undo some of what the Goal 8 Amendment does. You've heard some testimony about the 3 miles. Let me make sure at least give you my understanding of how that operates, because I think there's some misunderstanding among the members of your committee. It's 3 miles from high-value crop areas. It's not 3 miles from all farmland. It's not 3 miles from prime farmland. It's not 3 miles from unique farmland. All of those are words of art, and they're defined terms. It's only 3 miles from high-value crop areas. What the commission had in mind when it wrote that into the Goal 8 Amendment was, we've got 16 million acres of farmland out there that are in a farm zone. Not all of that is terribly valuable. Some of it is very marginal land. But certainly there is some of that which is extremely valuable. There are 2 million acres out of that 16 million acres that qualify as prime or unique. However, if we only protect, that is, declare the prime or unique lands off limits for resorts, we're leaving something out, and that is our high-value cropland. Most high-value cropland also coincides with prime land. Most of it tends to be prime land or unique land, but that's not always the case. There are some very high-value croplands that are not prime. They are not Class 1, Class 2. Some of them aren't even Class 3. I'll give you just one example. The Red Hills of Dundee. That's the state's premier wine grape growing area. It's probably one of the best in the country, and it's growing, and it's growing fast. That tends to be Class 3 soil. They're not prime lands. It's a jury soil. It's fairly steeply sloped, but it is just great for growing wine grapes. What the commission was worried about when it used the 3 mile limit, in fact, let me talk about it in the context of the testimony from Representative Schroeder. He was describing for you the Harbor Bench area, which is high value land. It grows lily bulbs. The destination resort site that he's talking about is separated from the Harbor Bench by a development. Way of thinking, you don't have the same kind of concern about keeping 3 miles away in that situation that you would have in the Hood River Valley, in the situation that was described in several earlier witnesses. With the Hood River Valley, there isn't any intervening large-scale development between the orchard land and the site of the resort. LCDC, again, was looking at large resorts not small resorts. A small resort obviously has less of an impact than a large resort. So I guess what I'm saying is you could look at that question again and perhaps make a distinction between the large resorts that are authorized by Goal 8, the smaller resorts that might be authorized by 3097, and also look at the situation in which you have intervening development between the high-value cropland and the site of the resort. There are a couple of other points in 3097 which create some problems. If you turn to page 2, down in section 5, lines 41 and 42, I understand from Russ Niebuhr, I spoke with him earlier, this is not really, the language that is here is not really what the planning directors wanted. They were trying to accommodate a rule of legislative council. This says that if you qualify under this language to build a resort, you don't need an exception from any goal. Well, what Goal 8 did was to say that if you met the qualifications in Goal 8, you didn't need an exception from Goal 3, agricultural lands, Goal 4, forest lands, the urbanization goal, Goal
5. I'm communicating without a telephone. We believe a better solution is optional local measured service. LMS, which is currently an option available to many of our Oregon customers, provides service at the lowest possible cost and permits the customer to control his or her telephone bill. Optional measured service in conjunction with a lifeline program utilizing direct funding would ensure that the needy would have telephone service at a time when local rates continue to rise because of deregulation and competition and the subsequent repricing of services to reflect more of their actual cost. Thank you for your time and attention, and be happy to answer any additional questions.
Thank you very much. Are there further questions? No, thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
This time I would call on Gene Kincaid and Davis Scotty with the Washington County Energy Coalition. Are they here?
Okay. I'm Gene Kincaid.
Excuse me, just sit down. Let me ask something. Are the representatives of PUC, the Public Utility Commission, here today to give testimony?
Prepare testimony.
Well, we may call it in here. Thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Good afternoon. I'm Gene Kincaid with Oregon Legal Services.
Welcome.
I practice in Hillsboro, and I'm here on behalf of the Washington County Energy Coalition and other residents in Washington County who are low income. I will briefly summarize my testimony rather than read it, and then answer your questions if you have any. We are generally in support of House Bill 2663 because it expands the current program to include...
Mr. Chair,
Representative...
Can you slow down? Just a
bit. Oh, okay. Sorry. Try that again.
Thank you.
We are generally in support of House Bill 2663 because it expands the current OTAP program to include all low-income citizens rather than just senior citizens. Originally, when the pilot program was, there were hearings held for it, the coalition was in support again. However, we objected to the fact that it was limited to only senior citizens. I went to several of the hearings, and there was virtually no testimony by any senior citizens at all. In support of limiting it to that only that group. So we are delighted to see that this bill would expand it to other people who are in need. Our primary objections continue to be that the program should not be administered by the Department of Adult and Family Services, not because they're not competent, but because of the dignity factor involved. And I think this is particularly true for senior citizens, perhaps more than younger individuals. The program as it exists now and as it is planned to be in House Bill 2663 bases it on eligibility for food stamps, not necessarily that the person be enrolled in the food stamp program. Unfortunately, it's been our experience that many senior citizens, for whatever reasons, primarily I think dignity and pride, refuse to enter a welfare office. And that will continue if the welfare program is the one that administers the subsidy. We are encouraging a program such as the LEAP program, which is quite familiar with dealing with low-income people, to administer the program, and it's my understanding that they are also supportive. Our main objection, I want to make it clear on the record, is that AFS and the connotation that it has, particularly for senior citizens, should not be the administrator of the program. We also are concerned about the amount of the subsidy. This limits it to 50% over the $15 per month. As you're probably all aware, the PUC just recently reduced our telephone rates. I'm not exactly sure what it's going to be in the Portland area, but we feel that this is not enough of a subsidy, particularly if people are going to have to apply for food stamps in order to get it, to entice people, particularly senior citizens, to come in and do that. So we would urge a greater subsidy, but more so we would urge consideration of deposits and installation charge factors. If the goal is universal service, we would assume that you also want to address people who are not currently using a telephone because they can't afford those fees. And as I read the bill, there's nothing in there to address that particular need. I believe I heard the last gentleman testify that they're willing to work with us on that, and I think that's good and really necessary in order to get all people on a telephone that want to have one. We are also opposed to the local measured service as a mandatory item. I can just speak from experience in that anyone that tries to call my office and talk to me is probably going to be on hold perhaps 5 or 10 minutes and might have to call me several times before they get me. And for individuals who do not have transportation, oftentimes this is their sole method of communicating with people. And I would hate to see them be restricted to local measured service because I believe in some instances you'll find that they'd end up paying more on that option with the subsidy than if they were allowed to have it anyway. The final message that I'd like to convey is that I believe the medical certificate program, which I understand is in a separate bill, should also be addressed. There's no reason to exclude the telephone companies from being within this program as the other utilities are. Some individual handicaps require a telephone while others don't. And as I understand the current rule, as it affects other utilities, you have to show a correlation between your medical condition and the utility that you need. So just because I may be wheelchair-bound, that might not make it necessary for me to have a telephone. But if I have a heart condition and there's no one around and I need to get a hold of my doctor, in that case, I might need a telephone. And that's really for the doctor or the medical personnel to make the decision and not for the telephone company or the PUC. Are there any questions?
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Representative Ekus.
Do you know how many low-income households the LEAP program reaches?
I don't, but I believe there are people here to testify that probably could say. Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Scotti, Gotchi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is David Scotchy, and I'm a member of the Washington County Energy Coalition, an organization of senior centers and human service agencies concerned with rising energy costs and the impact on low-income people. I would like to present testimony regarding this House Bill 2663, in particular address the administration mechanics of the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program as it's being proposed. House Bill 2663, sponsored by this committee at the request of the Oregon Independent Telephone Association, states that all Lifeline recipients must subscribe to the measured service option. Forcing a telephone customer to opt for local measured service is in direct contradiction to the November 1986 ballot initiative.
Mr. Scotchy, can I ask you to speak up just a bit and be sure you get it into the mic?
Okay. Again, forcing a customer to opt for local measure service is in direct contradiction to the November 1986 ballot initiative banning mandatory local measured service. It should not be the intent of any bill promoting lower telephone rates for low-income people to force them into potentially expensive local measured service. It has never been proven that low-income people use the telephone any less than other customer classes. For example, many seniors, especially the homebound, use the phone in lieu of leaving their home. The unemployed find the phone vital in searching for work, and working single parents use the phone to check in on the welfare of their children at home. To say that low-income people use the phone any less often than other income groups and would benefit from local measured service is an assumption based on faulty reasoning. We see that the attempt by the Oregon Independent Telephone Association to tie lifeline rates to local measured service as a way to circumvent the intent of last November's ballot initiative, which was overwhelmingly supported by Oregon voters. The Energy Coalition does not feel that funding OTAP through the general fund is wise or fair. The prime beneficiaries of the deregulation of AT&T have been the long-distance carriers and the businesses that have amassed savings from the drop in long-distance rates. It's no secret that businesses make a majority of the long-distance calls. On the other hand, basic phone rates have gone through the roof, and residential consumers have not benefited nearly as well from the reduction in long-distance rates, simply because they do not make nearly the same volume of calls. With the many demands on the general fund, we feel it is important to tax those who benefit most from deregulation and reduce the long-distance rates, the long-distance carriers. They have the option of passing costs onto those that use long-distance service most frequently. The Energy Coalition would like to see OTAP become less rigid in its administration. The Public Utility Commission set its sights very low in setting up the pilot program. The PUC determined that only food stamp eligible seniors should qualify for OTAP, despite the testimony of senior groups and human service agencies during the PUC hearings last year. Those groups stated that by making seniors the only age group in food stamps the qualifying agent, many groups of people in need of telephone basic service would either not be in the target group or worse, would potentially be in the target group if not for the food stamp requirement. Many seniors will not set foot in their welfare office and would rather do without than apply for food stamps, even if it means more expensive telephone bills. We feel that the food stamp requirement for a telephone program should be eliminated and that other agencies should be eligible to screen applicants for OTAP. The Low Income Energy Assistance Program, or LEAP, has very simple income guidelines to qualify for its program, and it would be an ideal program to help in the administration of OTAP. Currently, OTAP is administered by the PUC, which is not meant to administer a social program, and does not have the staff to do it justice, as evident by some of the problems and delays in signing people up for OTAP. It seems costly to have the telephone customer call the PUC, which in turn contacts Adult and Family Services to verify food stamp participation, which sends that information back to the PUC, which sends the application to the telephone customer, who sends the application to the local carrier. Why not have one agency both screen and qualify the applicant and eliminate the costly runaround? The LEAP coordinators of the Willamette Valley have already expressed interest in administering the program, and the LEAP guidelines would assure that those most in need could receive assistance. The natural tie-in between energy assistance and telephone assistance could help lessen some of the confusion about which organization or business is administering OTAP. Finally, the Energy Coalition would like to see telephones included in this shutoff protection law, which would prohibit disconnection if it endangered one's life or health. Telephones have been rightly touted as an essential part of daily life, but as the cost of basic telephone services rise, it becomes more and more difficult for low-income people to afford them. The Energy Coalition urges this committee to consider these recommendations to make telephone service more affordable and more accessible to low-income people. Thank you for giving me the time to speak. I answer questions.
Appreciate your testimony. Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Vikas.
I'm not sure who the information is supposed to be forthcoming. I'm not sure which person is going to provide it, so I'm going to keep asking it.
I guess.
How many low-income households does the LEAP program currently serve?
100,000 households statewide.
So you get as many households as food stamps program does. Are you reaching all food stamp households plus, or are you reaching less than all the food stamp households?
I am unable to answer that question. I can let you know afterwards. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Davis, PUC, do you want to give testimony on this bill? Would you like to come forward and let us ask you a couple questions?
He has a staff here.
He has staff here, too, but they didn't see you in the back, and I thought that I didn't want to embarrass them. Of course, now you're only one of their, but you're shortly going to only be one of their bosses, so maybe it doesn't make a difference.
Well, since I'm now without portfolio until I'm confirmed by the Senate, I guess my concern with some legislation is simply a conclusion that I've reached that the OTAP program was adopted in without support of legislation, and that it will terminate, I believe, at the end of June, and the ball has been tossed to the legislature. My concern also is that whatever program is adopted ought to be simple to administer, possibly at the risk that some people not entitled to the benefits would receive the benefit, but also with the expectation that we wouldn't spend a half to a third of the money on administration, regardless of how it's done. But I'm sure members of my staff are here to fill in for the details of the program as it is operated.
I appreciate that. I think you might comment further, I think, on the issue of the administration. Do you have any sense of where this ought to be administered?
Well, I have a sense that it doesn't belong in the PUC, and I agree about that, but I would rather have it in the PUC than to spend the money on administering it in some other agencies with our participation as a part of the burden. The other factor, it seems to me, is that it may well be time for us to adopt a program that allows for self-certification with the utilities themselves being responsible for saying that everybody who ought to be on the program is on the program in the simplest possible way, and possibly with the PUC doing an audit of their performance and reporting to the legislature.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. We appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Ekus.
I don't know what your intent is, but while there are staff here, I think it would be valuable for the staff to explain for the committee at least the FCC waiver provisions, because as we start working on the program, this is one of the things that begins to define to some extent the program, because it's usually directed at utilizing that, and every time you start trying to design it, you run up against that. So I think it'd be valuable for them to explain it. And before they do that, we have had a working group going on Lifeline, and I want to express the thanks to all the telephone companies that have participated and the public interest representatives that participated, but particularly to the two PUC staff members that have participated with us. They've been extremely valuable and extremely helpful. So
I appreciate your comments, and I might, before we get your comments, indicate to the audience that both this bill and the other one, which we'll be considering shortly, which is 3162, I will be turning over to our telecommunications subcommittee, which will be pulling the pieces together on these two bills. With that, welcome. And I think specifically any comments you want to make, but this reference to the FCC waiver program would be useful for us.
My name is David Booth, and I'm a telecommunication analyst with the PUC staff. and I am the person who has overall administrative responsibility for the OTAP program as it currently exists. I suppose, therefore, I'm probably the best person to discuss how the FCC program works and how OTAP is linked to that. I'll try to do that briefly, and if you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Thank you.
In January 1 of 1986, the FCC passed ordered the implementation of a lifeline program offer. Actually, the FCC doesn't do anything in terms of actually operating a lifeline program. They just merely made a source of funding available, and then they attached some strings to that funding and allowed the states, or actually telephone companies if they wish, to apply for certification to operate an FCC-sponsored program. Essentially, what the FCC proposes is that if a state wants to participate, they have to devise some means of selecting qualified participants for a lifeline program, and that means of selection has to include some kind of a verification of eligibility. In other words, they have, as far as I can tell and anyone else I've spoken with at the FCC, they have ruled out any kind of a self-certification process for FCC participation, in that by its nature, self-certification would not involve a verification of eligibility. The FCC, in its order, refers particularly to a linkage between a state program and an existing public assistance program. They listed some supplemental security income was mentioned. That's a federal Social Security program. The food stamps program was mentioned. That was the kind of thing they were thinking of when they wrote the order. As it exists now, the FCC will waive the $2 per month subscriber line charge that a customer now pays if they qualify for the program. They will waive that amount of money for all the customers that participate in the program. In order to obtain that waiver, the state must provide a matching amount of money. So if on the average for all the customers who participate there's a $2 waiver from the FCC, the state must come up with an average of $2 per customer, and in reality must also then pay for the administration of the program. So in fact the state has to come up with more than simply a matching amount. I want to try to be clear on this. I will mention that the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program, OTAP, as it currently operates, does provide a $2 waiver for every participating customer and a matching $2 state credit for a $4 benefit amount in total. It does not have to work that way. We did that for simplicity's sake more than anything else. In fact, however, what could happen is that all of that $2 per participating customer could be used in any way the state wishes, as long as it's to help these qualified customers. All of it could go to connection charges, for example. What happens is the companies, when they pay to the FCC, or actually to the National Exchange Carrier Association, their $2 a month that they receive from the customer, they are allowed by the FCC to retain that amount of money. That becomes a pool of money that can then be spent in a variety of ways. They could still charge their customer participating in OTAP $2 a month, but give them a break in some other way. Save them $1 a month and take $1 and use it some other way. There is a great deal of flexibility OTAP doesn't look that flexible, but I want to emphasize that it is actually more flexible than that. Now, OTAP was set up specifically to tap this federal source. It started into operation June 1 of 1986, and the order that put it in place sunsets it as of the end of June of 1987. So we're approaching the end. At this point, we have approximately 9,000 customers participating. When we first started the program, we, with the help of Adult and Family Services, sent out a notice to all persons who we thought would qualify, who were receiving food stamps or that Adult and Family Services identified as otherwise eligible for food stamps and were at least 60 years of age or older. This is only for the elderly and for food stamp eligible people. We sent out a mailing of something over 17,000 notices with an application form, and we got about a 50% response from that pool of eligibles. In general, I loosely say we serve about 50% of the potentially eligible food stamp customers known to, or food stamp recipients known to AFS. If we make a crude estimate that AFS serves about 50% of all those people who could possibly qualify for food stamps, and we're really only serving about 25% of the households who might be able to participate in such a program. My guess is, well, we currently have about 9,000 customers participating. I would guess that by the time we're through, we might be up close to 9,500, somewhere in that neighborhood. My estimate is that we'll spend about $120,000 administering the program this year. And in the process, we're going to be giving out, with the federal match, about $460,000 in benefits. So for every dollar we're giving in benefit, we're spending about 26 cents on administration. It's a relatively expensive thing to do. And I want to strongly point out that, in fact, the administrative costs of OTAP are substantially less than they would be if we really charged all of the costs that could possibly be charged to the program. My staff time is not charged to the program, and I probably have spent close to 50% of my time over the last 9 months on this, between reports and other things. There's a lot of staff time gone towards the OTAP at the clerical level, answering phones. Our consumer assistance staff has spent a lot of time dealing with customers. So there are other costs that would, in an ongoing program, not a trial program like this, a larger program would have to be assigned particularly to an assistance program. It is expensive to give away $4 a month. It probably costs as much to give away $4 a month as it would be to give away $100 a month. So it is something to consider.
Appreciate it very much.
Any questions?
Parkinson.
Yeah, you said FCC waives the $2, and then the state has to match that. Where did the matching money come from?
It comes from an assessment on long-distance access minutes for intrastate long-distance calling in the state. Long-distance carriers pay an access charge at the originating and terminating end of an intrastate long-distance call. And a portion of that goes to something called the Universal Service Fund, which is an assistance to high-cost companies within the state, mainly rural companies. And then there's a small amount left over within that fund that, which we have been using we do not have an official dedicated assessment for OTAP. And it comes, since it isn't dedicated, it's hard to know for sure, but my estimate is it's about 2/100ths of a cent per minute at present.
Thank you very much.
The Universal Service Fund as a whole, it's about 1/10th of a cent per minute.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
We do have a person here from Adult and Family Services today, so if anybody has a question in that direction, I want to draw that to your attention.
Okay. Thank you. Eric Strachan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Stashen. I'm the Utility Program Director for OSPIRD, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I'm also the Vice Chair of the Citizens Utility Board, and I'm here on behalf of both organizations in support of House Bill 2663 and the Lifeline Program. I guess I should state at the outset that we've been a part of the working group from the start. Actually, it was my idea to originate a working group to deal with both Lifeline and the issue of medical certificates and shutoff and deposit legislation. And I also would like to extend my appreciation to the PUC staff, people who've been participating, the telephone companies, and Representative Vikas. I think we support the legislation because we support the concept of universal service. And universal service is something just sort of like apple pie. Everybody supports it and nobody opposes it. But universal service seems to mean different things to different people. We often hear of universal telephone service as being defined as maintaining the current penetration rate that we have now, penetration rate being the percentage of households that have telephones, and I think it's somewhere just over 90% in Oregon. But every study we've seen shows that there's a major discrepancy in that penetration rate between upper and middle income households and low income households. In some areas, the low income household penetration rate is down below 70%. We think that's the necessity, the reason for having a Lifeline program, to close that gap between the penetration rates of middle and upper income households and those on the lower end of the income scale. And if you're going to do that, and we think it's a very worthwhile goal, you need a comprehensive program to eliminate all the barriers to low